Rambam, I'm sorry, the Ramban in the Hakdama to Shmos, I've mentioned this Ramban several times, says that the book of Shmos is divided into three different themes. Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus of Egypt, Matan Torah, and then culminating in Mishkan, building the Mishkan. And the Ramban says that this is the progress of spiritual growth, that we first must leave all of that which constrains us and limits us, our inner Mitzrayim, our egotism, our selfishness, our gaiva, and then we're ready to be makabel Hashem's Torah, to live by Hashem's will. But the ultimate goal of living by Hashem's will is that we bring the Shekhinah into our heart and our soul, which is what Hakamas HaMishkan is. Again, this pasuk is so important. V'yasu li mikdash, we make Hashem a mikdash, v'shachanti b'socham, so that He will dwell in our heart and our soul. It is not so much that the Shekhinah is in the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan, but the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan is a symbol of the divine presence that is within us. And that is why, although we of course commemorate the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash on Tisha B'Av, because both the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash were destroyed on Tisha B'Av, but in point of fact, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed much earlier. We don't have the date. The Beis HaMikdash was spiritually destroyed when the Bnei Yisrael were no longer worthy of Hashem's divine presence in their heart and their soul. And when that happened, the Beis HaMikdash was just a building. And if it was just a beautiful building, anybody could destroy it. The Medrash tells us that when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, he was miskoya, he was proud. He says, I've destroyed the house of God. I have been more powerful than the God of Israel, who they say made heaven and earth. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, I don't live there anymore. So you didn't destroy anything. In the Medrash language, you ground up flour that was already ground. So V'shachanti V'socham is really the dominant theme of Hakamas HaMishkan. That in order for us to merit a Beis HaMikdash, we have to make our heart and our soul a makom where the Shekhinah can live. And only when there's a V'shachanti V'socham do we merit V'yasuli Mikdash. Now there's another interesting point the Ramban makes in the Hakdama to the Book of Shmos. And it's a very oblique reference, a very short. It's just three words. But there's a lot of explanation in those three words. The Ramban defines Mishkan as Shavu Lamalas Avosam. They returned to the Madrega of the Avais, of Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Hakamas HaMishkan was a sign that they return after Matan Torah and after the forgiveness of the Chet HaEgel, and I'll discuss the chronological issues there. They returned to the love that Hashem had, the relationship Hashem had with the Avais. What's the connection? Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov didn't have a Mishkan, they didn't have a Beis HaMikdash. So the Ramban doesn't explain it, but I've seen Meforshim on the Ramban that say the following. If you remember, when Yitzchak Avinu sees Rivka, and Rivka, according to many interpretations, according to Rashi, was a young lady of only 3 years old. According to another view in Tosfos, she was 14 years old. Either way, Yitzchak was very definitely an older man. Yitzchak was 40, so whether she was 14 or 3, there was a very big age differential. But the pasuk says he brought her into the tent of Sarah his mother, and then he loved her, because only when he saw that she was a successor to Sarah Imena. And Rashi brings the beautiful medrash that there were three miracles that existed in the home of Sarah Imena. One was there was a bracha in her bread, which presumably means that if you ate anything from Sarah Imenu, it sustained you, it filled you up, you felt good for however long it was. The second that when a ner was lit l'chavat Shabbos, so apparently even in those days the avos lit the ner was daluk the entire week. And the third was there was a cloud of glory, a symbol of the Shekhinah, a physical evidence of the Shekhinah over the home of Sarah and Avram. And when Sarah Imenu died, in spite of the greatness of Avram Avinu, all of those signs left. And Rivka was able to bring it back. Now obviously this took time, because there at least had to be one Shabbos before you saw, actually two Shabboses, before you saw the candle burn the whole week. So when it says he brought her into the tent of Sarah Imenu, it's not like he brought her in and three miracles happened, but whatever it was, in the time that it took for those three miracles to reoccur, Yitzchak then realized. So what do you see? The Ramban points out, the Mefarshim of the Ramban point out, that the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash have three very similar miracles. There is the Lechem HaPanim, the showbread. These are 12 loaves of challah. Now again, I want to be clear that you understand this. The Torah describes on the golden table, the Shulchan, that was in the Mishkan, that there have to be 12 chalos. Now we think of chalos, we think of what you know, either what you make or what you buy. The truth is, lechem apanim could not be chametz. Lechem apanim were actually unleavened bread. When the Torah uses the word chalos, it does not necessarily mean leavened, but it just means anytime flour is mixed with oil, as opposed to being just baked with water, in the Lashon HaTorah, that is called chalos. In fact, the lechem apanim were matzah, but they were pretty thick matzah. Again, it was probably along the lines of the Yemenite matzah. Have you ever seen? It's a soft matzah. It's like a pita, but technically it's still matzah, not chametz. And it was a tefach thick. Tefach thick means this thick as your fist, as it were. And there were 12 chalos. And how did it work? They were baked every Friday, and they were put on the shulchan on Shabbos, and they would not be eaten by the Kohanim till next Shabbos, when they would be replaced by the new chalos, and the old chalos would be eaten. But the miracle of the Lechem Apanim was that in spite of the fact that they were on this shulchan for 8 days, and sometimes more if it was a Yom Tov and a Shabbos, because they had to bake it before Yom Tov, the bread was fresh and warm. And that corresponds to the miracle in Sarah's tent of Bracha Be'isa. The miracle of the Ner Daluk, Me'erev Shabbos Le'erev Shabbos, is of course the miracle of the Ner Tamid, that the menorah had 7 candles, and the menorah was normally relit every single evening. And yet, now this was not all the time, but when Klal Yisrael was Zeicha to this nes did not always happen. There was a Ner that never went out. This is called the Western candle, although it's a little strange. It's not quite the Western candle. It is actually second from the east. In other words, the menorah is located on the southern wall of the Mishkan, and it's in an east-west direction. East-west direction. So the Ner Ma'aravi, the Western candle, just means the candle that's immediately to the west of the easternmost candle. So really it's the second candle. Some opinions say it's the middle candle, because you have 7, so it's 3, 3. So Machlokas and the Gemara, what is the Ner that was the Ner Tamid? But this does correspond to the second miracle in Sarah's tent, of the Ner Daluk, Me'erev Shabbos Le'erev Shabbos. And the third miracle of Sarah's tent, the cloud of glory, of course, the Mishkan had. When the Mishkan was built, we're going to read that the Anan Hashem descended on the Mishkan, symbolizing that the Shekhinah was there. So, what's interesting is, the Mishkan in its miracles actually corresponds to the tent of Sarah Imenu. What is the lesson? The lesson is that the real Mishkan of Hashem is the Jewish home. The real Mishkan Hashem is the relationship of husband and wife and parent and child. And the Mishkan is just a reminder of what we are able to create within our homes. And that's what the Ramban means. Shavu l'malas avosam. The Mishkan was a tangible symbol that every Jewish home could recapture the home of Avraham Avinu and Sarah. So, you know, it's an old cliche, but, you know, cliches are usually true. That's why they're cliches, because they're said over and over again that the most important institution in Judaism, more than yeshiva, more than a shul, is the Jewish home. And in fact, that is why, halachically, when a kehillah starts, the very first institution they are obligated to have is a mikveh, even before a Beis HaKnesses, because a mikveh is the vehicle that enables the creation of a home, and in the home. And again, I mean, I don't want to get into feminist issues, but that is why the whole idea that, you know, when women say that the notion of equality requires that they do this and that and that and that in a Beis Knesset, whether it's an aliyah, whatever those particular issues are, it's misplaced, because it's turning the most important institution to be a Beis Knesset, when in fact it is the bias is the most important, and the Jewish woman is the Akeres HaBayis, is certainly the foundation of the home. Now, if men don't always appreciate that, that's their problem. That's our problem. That doesn't change the reality. Yes, do men need to be educated themselves as to the chashivas of what a bias is? Yeah, I'm going to be made. I'm not going to justify all of the insensitivity that you occasionally encounter. But it's a fundamental mistake not to understand how significant the Jewish bias is. And that is the Mishkan. The Beis HaMikdash is that. The three miracles of the Mishkan correspond to the Ohel of Sarah Imenu, which is what she created. So that's one important thing to keep in mind. Point number two, and this is a bit technical, but it's actually very interesting, and there's some important lessons here. I mentioned last week that in the events of Matan Torah, Rashi applies the rule of Ein Mukdam U'Meucher B'Torah. The Torah does not always speak chronologically, and therefore the whole story of building the Mizbeach and sprinkling the blood and saying Naseh V'Nishma, which in the Torah is recorded after the Aseret HaDibros. If you remember, Rashi took all of Perek Chaf Dalet in Shmos and he moved it before the Aseret HaDibros, because Rashi says, based on the Gemara in Shabbos, because Rashi says the Torah is not following chronological order, and certainly Naseh V'Nishma is pre-Matan Torah, although it is recorded after Matan Torah. So what did Rashi do? Rashi took something in the Torah that's written later, and he moved it earlier. When it comes to the Mishkan, Rashi does exactly the opposite. So Rashi does some major editorial rearranging of Sefer Shmos by invoking the principle of Ein Mukdam U'Meucher B'Torah. We have in the Torah Parshas Truma and Tetzave, all the details of the Mishkan and all the details of the Bigdei Kahuna, and all of them are written before the Chet HaEgel. And then we have the Chet HaEgel in Kisisa. Rashi says, out of order, all of the commandments concerning the building of the Mishkan were not given to Moshe until the Chet HaEgel, when he was in Har Sinai the third time, but when he was getting the second Luchos. And before the Chet HaEgel, the first time he was in Har Sinai, he did not get any details about the Mishkan, and the Torah is writing it out of order. Now, I want to point out, the same way the Ramban argued with Rashi about the sequencing of Matan Torah, because the Ramban likes to keep things in order, the Ramban says the exact same thing by the Mishkan, that in fact the commandments of the Mishkan preceded the Chet HaEgel. Moshe did not communicate the commandments to Bnei Yisrael till after the Chet HaEgel. That is Parshas Vayakel. Everybody admits that. But the Tzivuyim from Hashem to Moshe occurred earlier. So let's focus for a moment on Rashi. So Rashi's unusual shita is that a major part of Sefer Shmos, Truma, Tetzaveh, Kisisa, all of that, until the Egel, all of that is after the Chet HaEgel. Why is that so? So there's actually three explanations. Rashi does not give us the theology behind this, but there are three explanations for Rashi's opinion. The first is said by the Sopurno. And the Sopurno says a fascinating thing. The Sopurno says, had there not been a Chedo Ego, there would have been no need for a Mishkan. The Mishkan is a consequence of a certain the Mishkan is a consequence of a certain distancing that we experience as a result of the ego. Had there not been a Chedo Ego, and the Yidden at Matan Torah reached the Madrega of Adam HaRishayim Kaidam HaChet, there wouldn't have been death, there wouldn't have been forgetting of Torah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have been accessible everywhere. The whole world, or at least Eretz Yisrael, would have been a Beis HaMikdash. You don't need a special place. You don't need special people. You don't, like Kohanim, you don't need special rituals. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be available everywhere. The Mishkan, which says, and the Mikdash by extension, which says you can only serve me in this place, and only special people, and special halachas, and time and space limitations. As a result of the Chedo Egel, Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu still gave us a Makam Kadosh. But the Sopurno says, there's a certain merchak, there's a certain distancing, there's a certain limitation. So as a result, Rashi's understanding is, again, based on different chazals, that had there not been a Chedo Egel, there wouldn't have been a need for a Mishkan. The Mishkan and the Mikdash, in a sense, are a monument to the spiritual failure that arose because of the Chet HaEgel. That is explanation number one for Rashi's position. Explanation number two is a very interesting explanation offered by Rav Yehuda HaLevi in the Kuzari, where he says the following. All of us know, and again the Ramban talks about this, Rav Yehuda HaLevi talks about this, that the Chet HaEgel was not literally idolatry. The Jewish people did not believe that this golden calf that they created just this moment was the God that made them and God that made heaven and earth. And indeed, the Pasuk itself makes very clear that the Egel was perceived as a substitute for Moshe. They said, Moshe is late. They thought Moshe was late. He should have been down. They thought he must have died, etc. And they wanted the Egel because they don't have Moshe. And you can't even think that they thought Moshe was a god, because in the language of the Pasuk, Kum Aseh Lanu Elohim, make us a power, Asher Yelchu Lefonenu, that will go in front of us, Kizeh Moshe Ho'ish, underline, triple underline, Moshe the man. They're underscoring, he's not a god. So what is the ego? So again, the concept is that the Jewish people felt they needed a tangible intermediary. They needed a visualization. They needed a physical mechanism to connect themselves to God. They were not worthy. As finite material beings, they were not worthy of a connection to Hashem, and they perceived of Moshe as kind of a medium of what you might call spiritual channeling. And they said, now that we don't have Moshe, we need some other tangible symbol. Now it's an Aveira. Hashem doesn't want to be served that way. But it wasn't Avodah Zarah Mamish. But here is Rav Yehuda HaLevi says a very dramatic thought. Rav Yehuda HaLevi says that when the Jewish people demonstrate they have a weakness, when the Jewish people demonstrate they don't have the ability to relate to Hashem in the purest way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give them a way. He will give them what they need. So the Mishkan itself is that physical, tangible channeling of spiritual energy. The very thing they tried to accomplish with the ego, where they didn't have a tzivoy of Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu now gives them a miskeret, he gives them a framework by which they will be able to have it. And that is why in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you have what superficially almost looks like idolatry. The Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Aron HaKodesh, you have Kruvim. In fact, the Moabites who went in at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon said, oh, the Jews of the Avodah Zarah. The answer once again is Rabbi HaLevi says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the symbols that we need. The Gemara in Chulin even says that this is true by food. The Gemara says, any non-kosher thing that Hashem forbade, there is something kosher that has the same taste. So if a person has a taiva for a certain non-kosher food, there is something kosher that will have that same taste, right? So that's all the different, yeah. Yeah, so first of all, you see very clearly in the Torah that the word Elohim is often not referring to God, in which case we would say Elohim, but judges are called Elohim because it just refers to powers, and therefore this is the medium that will channel divine, you know, power into the world. Yeah.
Then why is the Edel considered a sin if it was just an intermediary?
Well, that itself is an ultimate sin, meaning to say...
Is the Mishkan also a sin then?
Well, in other words, again, what Hashem tells you to do, again, it's similar to the kosher and the non-kosher. If Hashem gives me something that tastes like crab, I can eat it, but I can't eat crab. Meaning that Kodesh Baruch Hu basically said, in the ideal world, you wouldn't have any kind of intermediary channelings. But if you need it... Now, it's very similar, by the way, to what the Rambam says in the Mora Nevuchim, about korbanos, although Rav Yehuda Levi doesn't accept the Rambam's view of korbanos, and that is, the Rambam says in the Mora Nevuchim, Hashem doesn't want korbanos either intrinsically, but since the Jewish people were enamored with pagan rituals, the ceremony, the pomp, the circumstance, and they even did human sacrifices, Rachman Ulitzlan, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them what they needed, and of course. Yehuda Levi himself does not learn Karbanos that way, but he kind of learns Mishkan that way. Of course, the big kasha and the Rambam, which maybe we'll leave when we discuss Sefer Vayikra, is, according to the Rambam, since most of us do not feel the emotional need for Karbanos, so why would we, in other words, once we've been weaned away, so to speak, why would we continue to pray for the restoration of korbanos, which we do, of course, if korbanos were only given to us because we were addicted to it, now we're not addicted anymore, right? Most of us don't even understand the power of korbanos. This is really the Ramban's kasha, and the Ramban indeed learns very differently that korbanos are extremely deep spiritual connection to Hashem. They are not just a concession. But be it as it may, that's korbanos, and we'll leave that for later. But Rav Yehuda Levi says, this is an important idea, that Hashem always gives you what you need. This is a very, very important yisod. You know, sometimes a person comes to a life of Torah, and they feel they have emotional needs. They feel they have pain in their life, and sometimes a person might feel that my religious life isn't giving me this. It's stopping me. It's blocking me. It's preventing me from connecting to that which really gives me happiness. The answer is, that can't be true. Now, maybe it's true in terms of a particular teacher, a particular chumra, a particular minhag. You know, one has to find the right connection. But it's a davar pashut, Rav Yehuda HaLevi says, that if a Yiddish neshama really has a need and it cannot find it in its existing structure within HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. Again, within Torah, I'm not talking about leaving Torah, God forbid. I'm talking about within Torah, there's going to be a way in which what a person needs is going to be addressed. Hashem doesn't simply leave you to your own devices, so to speak. And that's what Rav Yehuda Levi is saying the whole Mishkan is. Now, the third explanation is maybe the simplest explanation. And that's actually given by the Medrash, which is the basis of Rashi's chronology. And the basis of Rashi's chronology is simply this. After the Chet HaEgel, the Jewish people felt devastated. They felt rejected. They felt unworthy. They felt besmirched. Hashem said he wanted to destroy them and make a private covenant with Moshe. And then Moshe prays, and they pray, and they do tshuva. And Moshe finally comes down on Yom Kippur, the day of great forgiveness, with the second Luchos. The Mishkan was Hashem's comforting reassurance that He has forgiven the Jewish people. And the Shekhinah comes back. So according to this view, the Mishkan is not seen as either a punishment, as the Sephorno would have it, nor is the Mishkan seen as a psychological crutch, as Rav Yehuda HaLevi would have it, but the Mishkan is seen as the sign of divine forgiveness in the aftermath of Yom Kippur. So yes, had there not been a Chet HaEgel, Hashem wouldn't have to give us that sign, we wouldn't have sinned. So yes, it's because of the Chet HaEgel, but the Medrash suggests it's in a positive sense and not in a negative sense. The positive sense is to reassure. You know, as you know, even with our own children sometimes, you know, if a child is good, everything is perfect, we don't necessarily shower the child with affection, but if a child did something in which there's a merchak, sometimes, you know, and then there's a reconciliation, sometimes you have to go out of your way to hug the child and make him feel wanted. The Mishkan is Hashem hugging us and making us feel wanted in the aftermath of the Egel, and as a result of the great, great forgiveness of Yom Kippur. And that's why Yom Kippur became the day of forgiveness, because that is when Hashem forgave, accepted our tshuva, as in the aftermath of the Egel Hazar. Okay. Now, another halachic question, and I don't want to be overly technical, but I'll just throw it out very quickly. The mitzvah of Yasoli Mikdash is actually one of the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. If you look in the Rambam, look in the Sefer HaChinuch, look in all of the people who compile lists of mitzvahs. Mitzvos asay, to build a house for Hashem. And this is independent of Korbanos. In point of fact, Korbanos in theory don't even need a Beis HaMikdash according to Halakha. There's an active discussion, could we bring Korbanos today? The main problem we have in bringing Korbanos, putting aside the political problems of bringing Korbanos, which might be considerable, but the main problem is the problem of Tumah, since anyone that's ever been in a cemetery is permanently Tamei until we have the ashes of the Raduma. So Tumah is a problem. On the other hand, for communal offerings, Tumah is sometimes waived. So Korbanos is a separate issue. The Dion of Korbanot does not depend on whether you have a Beis HaMikdash. It just depends on whether we can overcome the problems of Tumah and some other problems. Who's a Kohen? No, those are problems. But there is a separate mitzvah of building a Beis HaMikdash. Now, we know, Lahalacha, the Rambam says in Hilchos Melachim, that the third Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt by Mashiach. And in fact, that's how you know. When somebody reveals himself as Mashiach, you don't really know he's Mashiach unless he succeeds in building the Bayis Shlishi. That's what the Rambam says. Rashi, in Maseches Shavuos, says something even more dramatic, that the third Beis HaMikdash is not going to be built by human hands whatsoever. It will be a building that will come down min hashamayim. So both according to Rashi and the Rambam, and it's very clear that we paskin basically like the Rambam. Now there is one view, just to be mashlim this, there is a minority view in the Talmud Yerushalmi that says we must build the Beis HaMikdash in order to bring Mashiach. So the Talmud Yerushalmi is the basis of the Temple Mount and various other movements that say you proactively have to build a Mikdash and bring Mashiach. But we don't paskin that way. We paskin like the Rambam that Binyan Beis HaMikdash is done by Mashiach. The question is, how could that be so though? If there's a mitzvah in the Torah of Yasuli Mikdash, then how can we basically say don't do it until Mashiach comes? You never say that by a mitzvah. You know, you gotta do mitzvahs. So let me just say b'kitzur that the Chassam Sofer offers an interesting explanation based on another comment of Rashi. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives Moshe the commandments of the Mishkan, he then ends, "K'chol asher ani mareh oscha," in accordance with everything that I show you as Tavnis HaMishkan, the configuration of the Mishkan and all of the Kalim, "Kein ta'asu," so shall you do. And Rashi says, "An v'chein tasu is l'dorot," that just as the Mishkan is built a certain way, So the future Beis HaMikdash, the Rishon, the Sheni, the Shlishi, must be built in the same manner. Now the Ramban asks on Rashi, he doesn't understand what Rashi means, actually it's a Chazal, that it must be done in the same manner. Certainly the dimensions of the Beis HaMikdash were not the same as the Mishkan. The size of the Mizbeach was not the same as the Mishkan. How can there be some principle that all of the future temples must be in the same manner? What does that mean? And the Ramban doesn't answer. The Ramban says he doesn't understand Rashi's comments. But the Chassam Sofer offers a very, very good explanation of Rashi, which is important halachically. He says that Rashi or Chazal do not mean physically they're the same dimensions, but it means that just as the Mishkan was not built until there was a direct revelation from Hashem to a Navi, so too every future temple requires the direct commandment of Hashem to a Navi. Meaning, although prophecy normally plays a very limited role in the halachic process. In fact, if a Navi comes and tells you, Hashem gave me a message, how are you supposed to do a certain mitzvah? We actually don't listen to him, because even when there were Naviim, because lo b'shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. There's a halachic process, and Nevuah is not part of the halachic process. A Navi cannot create a new mitzvah. A Navi cannot subtract from the mitzvahs. And a Navi cannot even decide a halacha when there's a machlokas. If there's a machlokas, whatever it is, Rav Yashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman, and a bona fide Navi, a real Navi, says, Hashem told me the halacha is like Rav Shlomo Zalman, or like Rav Yashiv, we do not listen to him. That's lo b'shamayim. So even though, in the halachic process, prophecy is basically not relevant, but when it comes to Mishkan, that's v'chein tasim, that the binyan beis hamikdash cannot be activated until there's prophecy, and that is why the Rambam says it is Mashiach who will build the third bayis, because before Mashiach comes, we will have the restoration of prophecy through Eliyahu HaNavi, and Eliyahu HaNavi will be the Navi that will give us the tzivoy of Mashiach. So the Chassam Sefer says, very logically, the reason why today we don't have a chiyuv d'oraisa to actively build the Beis HaMikdash is that Binyan Beis HaMikdash is makushar to the restoration of Nevuah in Am Yisrael. So until there is the restoration of Nevuah, we are disabled halachically from building the Beis HaMikdash. This is how the Chassam Sofer, it's really, it's very good explanation. This is what Rashi means when he says V'chein Tase L'dora. So I'll just throw out two questions I have on this. Huh?
Rashi says,
you're in Mishamayim. Yeah, that's Rashi in Shavuos, but the Chassam Sofer is explaining the Rashi in Truma, V'chein Tase L'doros. Also, even then, I have to say, even Rashi in Shavuos, it's not clear that Rashi means every single millimeter of the Beis HaMikdash will be Yorid Ben Shemayim, but it means essentially it'll come down from heaven, so we know Hashem is ready for us to do the rest. And there might be, you know, maybe the Kodesh HaKadoshim will come down or something like that. Now it just comes about historically, I have two kashas on the Chassam Sofer, because in point of fact we have two bits of historical data that after the Churban Bayis Sheni, Jews did start at least trying to build a third temple, even though they were not prophets. One, we know that the second Mikdash was destroyed by the Romans. The normal year we give is the year 70 of the Common Era. It's between 68 and 70, there's some exact uncertainty. Now we know that around 65 years later, 70 years later, we have the Bar Kokhba revolt. And we know that Rabbi Akiva actually thought, the great Rabbi Akiva, the Gadol Hador, thought Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. That's why he called him Bar Kokhba, the son of a star. His real name, which is actually very telling, was Shimon ben Kuziva. Now Kuziva is related to Kazav, disappointment or falsity. It's interesting. His real name actually reflected the Messias. Rabbi Akiva called him Bar Kokhba. And the Bar Kokhba revolt was initially very, very successful. Bar Kokhba liberated 900 cities or villages from Roman rule and created a separate Jewish state. And there is some, it's not so clear, but there is some archaeological evidence on the Temple Mount that foundations were laid for a third Beis HaMikdash under the supervision of Rabbi Akiva. It is thought, again it's a speculation, and then of course Hadrian crushed the revolt mercilessly at Beitar, and really the numbers of people who died in the Bar Kokhba revolt were much greater, the Gemara itself says, than the aftermath of the Korban Beis HaMikdash. And in fact most of the Gezeris of the Romans against religion, against Torah learning, were actually in the aftermath of Beitar, more so in the aftermath of the Korban. They destroyed the Mikdash, of course, that's an unfathomable tragedy, but Jews were still allowed to learn Torah and even live in Yerushalayim after the Korban. After Beitar they were banished from Yerushalayim, and that's when we have all the gezeros about teaching Torah and not doing bris mil. All of that is the aftermath of Beitar, because Hadrian decided he had to crush the Jewish revolt. This was the second revolt. He had to crush the Jewish revolt, absolutely. In fact, that is when Eretz Yisrael was renamed Palestine. Palestine was the invention of Hadrian. Palestine means the land of the Philistines. There were no Palestinians. Palestinians were gone for a thousand years before that. But it became the land of the Philistines, no longer Judea. It used to be Judea, the land of the Jews. He called it Palestina, the land of the Philistines. Yerushalayim itself was renamed, as you know, Aelia Capitolina. It was turned into a temple to Jupiter, etc. A very, very bad period. So the point I'm making is, though, if indeed the archaeological evidence is there, and again, I have not fully evaluated it, you do have a problem. How could Rabbi Akiva, in other words, was there a Navi? I mean, if there was no Nevuah, where did Rabbi Akiva get the halachic right to assist in the building of a mikdash? That's a kasha on the Chazam Sofer. And another kasha is around 200 years later, after Rome had converted to Christianity. So the Christians obviously persecuted the Jews tremendously, but at some point there was a pagan emperor who didn't like Christianity. He liked the old idolatrous ways of Rome, and he is known in Christian history as Julian the Apostate. But Julian the Apostate actually liked Jews. He hated Christians and he liked Jews, interestingly enough. And he gave permission to the Jewish people to rebuild the temple. And once again, historians indicate that a foundation was laid. But here, there was a tremendous earthquake in the Har HaBayis. And it destroyed everything. This was around the year 400 or so. And once again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is obviously telling Am Yisrael that this is not the time. But again, I'm just asking the same question. Where was the Navi? So these are just two historical issues on the Chasam Sofer. But at least LaHalacha, we're more or less somech on the Chasam Sofer. It's really the Rambam. That since the Rambam says, Binyan Beis HaMikdash awaits Mashiach, the Chasam Sofer explains, we need Nevuah. That's why we don't bomb the Temple Mount right now. We're somech on the Rambam and on Rashi. But the Svarim tell us that even though we do not have the mitzvah of physically building the Beis HaMikdash Bizman HaZeh, we do have the mitzvah of spiritually preparing ourselves by making ourselves ra'oi for the Divine Presence. And therefore, in that sense, Binyan Beis HaMikdash applies today in the sense of Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. I make my heart a Mishkan for Hashem. So as a result, when we look at the steps that the Jewish people took in trying to build a Mishkan, we can learn about how we build our own Mishkan and prepare ourselves for Hashra'as HaShechina. So what would these steps be? So let me just mention relatively quickly a very beautiful comment of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. The Orach Chaim, right in the beginning, we have a list of all of the materials that are needed: zahav, gold, silver, nechoshes, techeles, right, all these different materials. And it seems to go from the most valuable to the least valuable. Gold is number one, then silver, then copper. But then, at the very end of the list, it mentions avnei miluim, which are the precious stones that are in the Kohen Gadol's breastplate. Now these involve different translations, but there's Yahalom, which, you know, there are diamonds, rubies, sapphires. So the Or HaChaim asked the Kasha, given the fact that the Avnei Miluim were phenomenally valuable, why are they put at the end of the list and not put at the beginning of the list? And we know how valuable they were. Do you remember the famous story? The Gemara in Kedushin is a famous story about a non-Jew from Ashkelon, Dama ben Nesina, who exemplified Kibbut Aviyim, that he once had a precious jewel that was needed, Choshen, and the key to the jewelry box was under his father's pillow. And he didn't want to wake up his father, although I've always had a caution that my, you know, dad wakes up, hey dad, you know, I honor you so much, you know, we lost $50 million today, but I didn't want to disturb your nap. I'm not sure if dad would be so happy about that. But be it as it may. So by the way, the Gemara, I want to point out, the Gemara is not saying, just a little point, the Gemara is not saying that if you are actually confronted with that situation, that's what you should do. In point of fact, most of the time you're supposed to wake up your father, because that's what he would want. Dava ben Nesina made a wrong decision, but his motivation for that decision was the honor he had for his parents. So Chazal are not mishabeach the decision, you see, they're mishabeach how much kavod he had, even though his decision happened to be wrong. No, we say goyish kup, as they say, whatever it would be. No, so again, he's very, very praiseworthy, extremely praiseworthy, but lemaisa it would not have been the right decision to make. But you see that they offered him so much money, and in the next year, in reward for his mesiras nefesh, he was given a para aduma, which also could command a huge amount of money. So the kasha the Or HaChaim asks is, why are the Avnei Miluim put at the bottom of the list? So the Or HaChaim gives us three answers. Answer number one is a technical answer, and that is, all of the other materials were actually used in the Mishkan. The Avnei Miluim are only used on the Kohen's garments, and therefore they're less kadosh, because they're not actually used in the Mishkan itself. That's answer number one. Answer number two is this. The Pasuk says in Kisisa that the Avnei Miluim were donated by the Nesiim. That was their personal gift. Now, according to the Medrash, the Nesiim waited to see what everybody else gave. And they said, we'll fill in whatever is missing. The Or HaChaim says, a Jew has to be proactive and not reactive. Because if you truly want to serve Hashem, you can't really hold yourself back. You want to do. If you sit back and wait until other people do everything, and then you fill in the gaps. Number one, there's always the possibility of a certain gaiva, because you want to see what everybody else does, and then you can do something better. And number two, there's a chisaron in the spontaneous generosity and love that you have for Hashem. And therefore, the Nesiim's contribution is relegated to the bottom of the list because it didn't come from the spontaneous welling up of generous spirits. That is the Or HaChaim's second answer. And then the Or HaChaim's third answer is also important. It's based on another medrash. It says, the Nesiim gave the Avnei Miluim. Now the word Nesiim is a pun, a double meaning. Nesiim, of course, means the heads of tribes. But Nesiim also means clouds, anonim. Nesiim is a Tanakh term for anonim. So, the Medrash tells us, the Nesiim got the Avnei Miluim in the clouds that brought their man in the morning. Hashem gave them a gift for their service. As a result, the Or HaChaim says, when the Nesiim parted with their Avnei Miluim, it was easy come, easy go. There was no struggle. There was no effort. There was no sacrifice. They weren't really giving up anything because they didn't earn it. It just came to them. As opposed to Bnei Yisrael, who gives Zav and Kesef. Now they got that from Mitzrayim, but that was compensation for which they worked and struggled and died and suffered for 210 years. So when they gave up that compensation that they got for their services, that represented a struggle and a sacrifice. And the Or HaChaim says an important yesod. Since Pirkei Avos tells us, Lefum Tzara Agra, according to the pain is the reward. The poor person who gives $5 or 5 shkalim might be a more meaningful mitzvah than a very wealthy person who gives $1,000. Because everything is based on the sacrifice and the struggle. Therefore, Hashem puts the Avnei Miluim at the end of the list, because although quantitatively it was the most valuable thing of all, it didn't come from struggle and effort. Now, we give lip service in all of our schools. Whatever it is, the only thing that counts is the effort you put forth, but that's not what the report card says. Right? But in Hashem's celestial report card, that is exactly what it says. Now, we can't always gauge effort, etc., but the Ribbono Shel Olam says, you've given me what you could that is more beloved to me than even greater accomplishments that don't involve that pain and that struggle and that sacrifice. So far, we've mentioned two ideas from the Or HaChaim in building our Mishkan. One, to be proactive, to look at what I can do for Hashem and for the Jewish people. Don't just wait till you're proud, but look around in your life, in your community, in your family. What can I do to be Mekadesh Hashem, bring nachas to the Ribbono Shel Olam? And two, recognize the importance of struggle. Meaning, even when we fail, we're not successful. Hashem is not looking at how successful we are. Or to put it another way, the measure of our success is not if we achieved a certain result, but that we tried the best that we could to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They tell a story about Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, that a man went over to him before Rosh Hashanah, and a man asked him, you know, Rebbe, I have such a hard life. Could you please pray to Hashem to make it easier? And you know, it's not because I want an easy life. I want to learn more. I want to do more mitzvahs. I want to give more tzedakah. I want to serve Hashem better. Could He remove my difficulties? And the Berdichever said, that is a worthy prayer indeed. And I will be mispalel and you will be mispalel. But after Rosh Hashanah, when the person's matzav didn't get better, he went to the Berdichever and said, why? Nothing happened. The Berdichever looked at him quite sadly and said, I'm sorry, Hashem likes what you're doing now better. This gives more nachas than the alternative. So that could give us a little chizuk, you know, when we encounter the difficulties. We have to know that it's not a failure. It's a success. It's a hatzlacha to keep on going. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu is machshav the lesser contribution, which is worth more than the greater contribution. Now let me mention two other ideas very quickly. Maybe three other ideas. We're running out of time, but I want to just at least mention them. And that is, when the Torah emphasizes giving to Hashem, it emphasizes over and over again that it's for Hashem. Truma l'Hashem. Yikru li truma. And that is, one should try to act l'shem shamayim. You ask it, again, as human beings, it's very hard to factor out our ego. But one must try to always ask, what gives nachas to Hashem? As opposed to a personal agenda. Here I just want to tell you a very quick maisa with the Panovitcher Rav. Panovitcher Rav, again, was a truly amazing, amazing gadol in so many ways. An absolute gadol b'Torah, who knew Shas and Poskim, but a tremendous lover of Jews. You know, there were 800 community rabbanim in Lithuania before the Holocaust. He was the only survivor. He was the only community Rav in Lita who survived. And as a result, he was a man with an obsession. His obsession was, why did Hashem give him life? And he devoted his life to building Torah, not just Panovich, but really many, many yeshivas, hospitals, orphanages. He took into his own home, he and his Rebbetzin took in countless children. And he traveled all over the world to finance all of these projects. And he once said that the biggest sacrifice he made in his life were all of the Svarim and Chidushei Torah that he could have compiled had he focused on his own growth. But he said it was time to do for Hashem. So he was a spellbinding artist. I don't know if any of you ever had the chance to hear him. But he was, humor and funny and tochen and all sorts of things. So the story goes, he once came to Chicago the same day as a mashulach from the much smaller Navardic yeshiva in Bnei Brak. So when the Panovich Rav walks in and you're also collecting for your institution, you kind of figure, oh, this is not going to be a good day. So the mashulach figured, I'm not even going to ask people for money. I'm just going to listen to the brilliant, magnificent Divrei Torah of the Panovich Rav. And I'll learn something, I'll listen. I'm going to take this off as my own learning day. So he sits, and the Panovich Rav is, as he always was, brilliant and funny and emotional and moving and inspirational. And people are pulling out their checkbooks, and they're going to write, a generous check. And at the end of the speech, the Rav says, Rabosai, there's a gentleman here from a very, very fine yeshiva in Bnei Brak that helps people tremendously. Please, please, all the money you would give me, please give him. Well, suffice it to say that the Mashulach from Novartik had a much better day than he ever had before. He got quite a lot of money. And he went over to the Rav afterwards and says, Rebbe, I'm so grateful. This is so amazing. But I just don't understand. You traveled all the way from Eretz Yisrael for your Mosad. How could you give it all up? And the Rav told him, I don't know what you mean, my Mosad, your Mosad. We're all doing the same thing. If we have enough money that 20 people could learn Torah for 6 months, why do I care, he said, if the 20 people are in Panovich or the 20 people are in the Vardik? He said, it's a matter of total indifference to me because Hashem gets nachas both ways. Now this is rare. You need the Panovich Rav to have this hashkafa. But this is the epitome of L'shem Shemayim. He didn't care. The question is, how many mitzvahs are being done? How much Torah is being learned? How much tzedakah is being given? Whether it goes to this one or that one, that's a matter of ego. And he says, ego, again, this is a high level. I'm not claiming to be on that Madrega myself. But he said, ego has nothing to do with it. And that is the epitome of L'shem Shemayim. And then finally, right, so we've talked about proactive and not reactive. We talked about recognizing the integrity of a struggle, even if you're not ultimately successful. And number three, L'shem Shemayim, try to get our egos out of the picture. Very hard. That's a hard one, right? That's especially a hard one. The Chazon Ish gives us a thought experiment, by the way, to test. It's a test. It's a hard test. Almost nobody would pass it. It's one of those tests that nobody would pass. Let's say you're a person who loves to have orchim. You love to have hospitality. You love to share your home with others. And it's Friday night and you don't have an oreach for Shabbos, so you feel bad. I want to do chesed. And you finally see a stranger. And you go over to the stranger and you say, do you have a place to eat? I'd love you to come to my home. And the stranger says, oh, thank you so much, but 5 minutes ago, so-and-so invited me. Chazon Ish says, stop! Do you feel good or do you feel bad? This is a very... Right. So, this is a hard experiment, but the Chazon Ish says, if the person is taken care of in a good way, it's a good family, it's going to be a good experience for him, and you feel bad, there must have been an element of egotism in the request. Because if the ikker concern was, I want a yid to be in a comfortable, good environment, I want him to be taken care of, I care about him or her, then l'may nafka mina, once again, if it's your house or somebody else's house. If it has to be your house. Now again, certainly, these are very, very high madrigas, and if a person is a true, true Baal Chesed, even if we get that certain enjoyment, Baruch Hashem, go ahead and do it. One should certainly do mitzvos on that level, and will get much, much schar. It's a wonderful thing. But if you think about the highest spiritual levels, you can actually reach a level in which, who cares if it's me or not? You know, I remember when my son was in first grade, and it struck me. He came home and he was very excited. There was a contest about who would be the best in something. And he was so excited that one of his friends won first prize. And I was thinking, I didn't say it, gee, why didn't my son win first prize? Because, you know, as we get older, we get, you know, a little jealous, you know, even of our friends' successes. But I was so impressed at the genuine simcha that he had that somebody else, you know, won. And with mitzvahs, it's the same thing. If people are doing mitzvahs, we sometimes kind of think, oh, you know, why didn't I do that? Why didn't I, you know, either in terms of being jealous or in terms of even berating ourselves. You know, why didn't I do that? But if you look at things going on in the world that bring nachas to Hashem, one should get the same simcha when someone else does a great mitzvah. Baruch Hashem, that something brought joy to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's yet the other thing about L'shem Shemayim, trying to factor out our agenda. Let me just mention one final thing, and this is a very famous word. The Torah says, Vayikhu li truma, take for me truma. Everyone asks the question. Moshe is telling B'nai Yisrael to give. It shouldn't say, tell B'nai Yisrael to take. It should say, tell B'nai Yisrael to give. And the classic answer that many, many Mefarshim say is that Yid has to feel that when I give something in Hashem's service, I'm taking much more than I'm giving. That in reality, the attitude is not that I'm sacrificing. In fact, there was a maisa with Rav Shach once. it's a hard maisa in which a boy was going to get engaged to a young woman. And the young woman came in, and the young woman said, I'm willing to make every sacrifice for Torah. I'm willing to suffer. I'm willing to undergo every deprivation. And she said, no matter what it takes. So Shach told the person, break off that shidduch immediately. Because if somebody comes in with the attitude, I'm going to suffer the rest of my life, but I'm going to do it, that doesn't last. The attitude of martyr doesn't last. It should be the opposite. To me, it's not suffering. To me, it's good. Again, it's a hard, also a high standard, but this is the maisa they say with Rav Shach. So it's the same thing. A person shouldn't feel, I'm suffering. Aliyah is an interesting example, right? I mean, I'm still relatively recent Oleh. You know, on one hand, we can tell ourselves, oh, I gave up so much being here, so much. No, this is so hard, but okay, I'm going to suffer because Hashem wants Jews to live in Eretz Yisrael. Should be the opposite, right? Talking to myself, it should be, Baruch Hashem, I'm getting much more than I'm giving. Right? And that's Vayik. And they tell the story about the altar of Nepardik, who is a very kind of an extreme person in many ways, very unusual person. We'll have to talk about it some other time, B'Arichas. But the story goes that he once went to a miser in a town, and he got a very, very big donation for his yeshiva. So another Rosh Yeshiva went to him and said, you know, I've been going to this gevir for so many years, and I only get a token donation. How do you get so much? So he tells the miser, oh, I'll tell you, he tells the Rosh Yeshiva, I'll tell you your problem. You walk into this big man, this rich man's house, and you're impressed with the furniture and the rugs, and you wipe your feet, and you know, you don't sit on the sofa because you don't want to ruffle the upholstery. You make him feel he is in possession of so many good things. You then ask him to give you something? People don't want to give. You're asking him to give what you consider to be so valuable. I walk in, you know, I track mud in the house. You know, I put my shoes on the table. Again, I'm not sure if this was literal. He says, I convey to this person the idea, you have nothing at all. All of your stuff is worthless. It's just physical garbage. But I will give you a chance to make this worth something. He says, so, I'm not asking him to give. I'm asking him to take. And since people like to take and not give, I get a lot of money. And again, I don't even know if this story is true. This is recorded. This is recorded. And I'm not giving any practical hadracha for fundraisers. It may not work. But again, it exemplifies the idea that in Avodas Hashem, we should feel that we're getting the better part of the deal, and that's why it says v'yikra. So b'kitzer, our lessons in building our own Beis HaMikdash, be proactive, not reactive. Appreciate the significance of your struggle. Try to factor out the egotism and focus on what brings Hashem nachas, and always try to feel in our own lives that we're getting more than we're giving. And in that way, we build our mikdash, and if we build our mikdash for Shachanti B'Tocham, we will merit the third mikdash being Yored Min HaShemayim, B'mheir V'Yameinu.